Heidi de la Rey lay awake and listened to the bombers. They had come on three successive nights. The centre of the city was devastated, the opera house and the railway station totally destroyed, and from the information which she had access to in the Department of Propaganda, she knew of the Allied successes in France and Russia. She knew the truth of the 100,000 German troops captured by the Russians at Minsk. Beside her, Colonel Sigmund Bolt slept restlessly, rolling over and grunting, so she was even more disturbed by him than by the distant American bombers. She had reason to worry, she thought. All of them were worried since the abortive attempt to assassinate the Führer. She had seen the films of the execution of the traitors, every minute detail of their agony as they hung on the meat hooks, and General Zoller had been one of them. Sigmund Bolt had not been one of the conspirators. She was certain of that. But he was close enough to the plot to be caught up in the tidal wave that flowed from it. Heidi had been his mistress for almost a year now, but she had begun to notice the first signs of his waning interest in her, and she knew that his days of influence and power were numbered. Soon she would be alone again, without special food rations for herself and little Lothar. She listened to the bombers. The raid was over, and the sound of their motors dwindled away to a mosquito hum. But they would be back. In the silence after their departure, she thought about Manfred and the letters he had written to which she had never replied. He was in Lisbon, and in Portugal there were no bombers. She spoke to Sigmund the next day at breakfast. "It is only little Lothar I am thinking of," she explained, and she thought she saw a glimmer of relief in his expression. Perhaps he had already been calculating how he could be rid of her without a fuss. That afternoon she wrote to Manfred, care of the German consulate in Lisbon, and she enclosed a photograph of herself and Lothar. Colonel Sigmund Bolt moved quickly. He still had influence and power in the department, sufficient for him to procure her travel pass and documents within a week. And he drove her out to Tempelhof Airport in the black Mercedes and kissed her goodbye at the foot of the boarding ladder of the Junkers transport aircraft. 3 days later, Sigmund Bolt was arrested in his home at Grunewald, and a week later he died under interrogation in his cell at the Gestapo headquarters, still protesting his innocence. Little Lothar de la Rey caught his first glimpse of Africa, peering between the rails of the Portuguese freighter as it steamed into Table Bay. He stood between his father and mother, holding their hands and chuckling with delight at the steam tugs that came bustling out to welcome their ship. The war had ended 2 years ago, but Manfred had taken extraordinary precautions before bringing his family to Africa. First, he had written to Uncle Tromp, who had been released from internment at the end of the war, and from him learned all the family and political news. Aunt Trudy was well, and both the girls were married now. Rolf had been released at the same time as Uncle Tromp and had returned to his job at the university. He and Sarah were happy and well and expecting another addition to their family before the year's end. Politically, the news was promising. Although the Osewa Brandvag and the other paramilitary organizations had been discredited and disbanded, their members had been absorbed into the National Party under Dr. Daniel Malan, and the party was rejuvenated and strengthened by their numbers. Afrikaner unity had never been more solid, and the dedication of the massive Voortrekker monument on a kopje above Pretoria had rallied the Volk, so that even many of those who had joined Smuts's army and fought in North Africa and Italy were flocking to the cause. A backlash was developing against Smuts and his United Party. The feeling was that he placed the interests of the British Commonwealth, which he had done so much to bring into being, before the interests of South Africa. Furthermore, Smuts had made a political misjudgment by inviting the British royal family to visit the country. And their presence had served to polarise public feelings between the English-speaking jingoists and the Afrikaners. Even many of those who had been Smuts's men were offended by the visit. Dr. Hendrik French Vervoorde, who had left his teaching post at Stellenbosch University to become the editor of Die Vaderland, allowed only one reference to the royal visit in his newspaper. He warned his readers that there might be some disruption of traffic in Johannesburg owing to the presence of foreign visitors in the city. On the occasion of the Loyal Address at the opening of the South African Parliament, Dr. Daniel Malan and all his nationalist members had absented themselves from the House in protest. Uncle Tromp ended his letter. "So we have come through the storm strengthened and purified as a bulk, and more determined than ever in our endeavours. There are great days ahead, Manny. Come home. We need men like you." Still, Manfred did not move immediately. First, he wrote to Uncle Tromp again. In veiled terms, he asked what the position was with regard to a white sword he had left behind. And after a delay, he received assurance that nobody knew anything about his sword. Discreet inquiries through friends in the police force had elicited the information that although the dossier on the missing sword was still open, it was no longer under active investigation, and nobody knew its whereabouts or to whom it belonged. It must be assumed that it would never be found. Leaving Heidi and the boy in Lisbon, Manfred travelled by train to Zurich, where he sold the remainder of the diamonds. In the post-war euphoria, prices were high, and he was able to deposit almost £200,000 in a numbered account with Credit Suisse. When they reached Cape Town, the family went ashore without attracting attention, although, as an Olympic gold medalist, Manfred could have found himself the centre of a great deal of publicity if he had wished. Quietly, he felt his way, visiting old friends, former OB members and political allies, making certain there were no nasty surprises in store for him before he gave his first interview to the Burger newspaper. To them he explained how he had passed the war in neutral Portugal because he had declined to fight for either side. But now he had returned to the land of his birth to make whatever contribution he could to political progress towards what was every Afrikaner's dream, a Republic of South Africa, free from the dictates of any foreign power. He had said all the right things, and he was an Olympic gold medalist in a land where athletic prowess was venerated. He was handsome and clever and devout, with an attractive wife and son. He still had friends in high places, and the number of those friends was increasing each day. He purchased a partnership in a prosperous Stellenbosch law firm. The senior partner was an attorney named Van Schuur, very active in politics and a luminary of the Nationalist Party. He sponsored Manfred's entry into the party. Manfred devoted himself to the affairs of Van Schuur and de la Rey, and just as single-mindedly to those of the Cape Nationalist Party. He showed great skills as an organiser and as a fundraiser, and by the end of 1947 he was a member of the Broederbond. The Broederbond, or Brotherhood, was another secret society of Afrikaners. It had not replaced the defunct Osewa Brandvag, but had existed concurrently and often in competition with it. Unlike the OB, it was not flamboyant and overtly militant. There were no uniforms or torchlit rallies. It worked quietly in small groups, in the homes and offices of powerful and influential men, for membership was only bestowed upon the brightest and the best. It considered its members to be an elite of super-Afrikaners, whose end object was the formation of an Afrikaner republic. Like the disbanded OB, the secrecy surrounding it was ironclad. Unlike the OB, a member must be much more than merely a pure-blooded Afrikaner. He must be a leader of men, or at the very least a potential leader. and an invitation to join the Brotherhood held within it the promise of high political preference and favour in the future republic. Manfred's first rewards of membership came almost immediately, for when the campaign for the general election of 1948 opened, Manfred de la Rey was nominated as the official nationalist candidate for the marginal seat of Hottentots Holland. 2 years previously, in a by-election, the seat had been won for Smuts' United Party by a young war hero from a rich English-speaking Cape family. As the incumbent, Chasseur Courtney had been nominated by the United Party as their candidate to contest the general election. Manfred de la Rey had been offered a safer seat, but he had deliberately chosen Hottentots Holland. He wanted the opportunity to meet Chasseur Courtney again. He recalled vividly their first meeting on the fish jetty at Walvis Bay. Since then, their destinies seemed to have been inextricably bound together in a knot of Geordian complexity, and Manfred sensed that he had to face this adversary one more time and unravel that knot. To prepare himself for the campaign, as well as to satisfy his brooding enmity towards them, Manfred began an investigation of the Courtney family, in particular Chasseur and his mother, Mrs. Santaine de Thierry Courtney. Almost immediately he found areas of mystery in the woman's past, and these grew deeper as his investigations continued. Finally, he was sufficiently encouraged to employ a Parisian firm of private investigators to examine in detail Santaine's family background and her origins. On his regular monthly visit to his father in Pretoria, Central Prison, he brought up the Courtney name and begged the frail old man to tell him everything he knew about them. When the campaign opened, Manfred knew that his investigations had given him an important advantage, and he threw himself into the rough and tumble of a South African election with gusto and determination. Santaine de Thierry Courtney stood on the top of Table Mountain, a little apart from the rest of the party. Since Sir Gary's murder, the mountain always saddened her, even when she looked at it from the windows of her study at Veldhoven. This was the first time that she had been on the summit since that tragic day, and she was here only because she could not refuse Blaine's invitation to act as his official partner. And, of course, I am still enough of a snob to relish the idea of being introduced to the King and Queen of England. She was truthful with herself. The Ubas was chatting to King George, pointing out the landmarks with his cane. He was wearing his old Panama hat and baggy slacks, and Santaine felt a pang at his resemblance to Sir Gary. She turned away. Blaine was with the small group around the royal princesses. He was telling a story, and Margaret Rose laughed delightedly. "How pretty she is," Santaine thought. "What a complexion, a royal English rose." The princess turned and said something to one of the other young men. Santaine had been introduced to him earlier. He was an Air Force officer, as Chasseur was, a handsome fellow with a fine, sensitive face, she thought, and then her female instincts were alerted as she caught the secret glance the couple exchanged. It was unmistakable. And Santaine felt that little lift of her spirits she always enjoyed when she saw two young people in love. It was followed almost immediately by a return of her somber mood. Thinking of love and young lovers, she studied Blaine. He was unaware of her gaze, relaxed and charming, but there was silver in his hair, shining silver wings above those sticky-out ears she loved so well. And there were deep creases in his tanned face, around the eyes, and at the corners of his mouth and his big aquiline nose. Still, his body was hard and flat-bellied from riding and walking, but he was like the old lion. And with a further slide of her spirits, she faced the fact that he was no longer in his prime. Instead, he stood at the threshold of old age. "Oh, God," she thought, "even I will be 48 years old in a few months. and she lifted her hand to touch her head. There was silver there also, but so artfully tinted that it seemed merely a bleaching of the African sun. There were other unpalatable truths that her mirror revealed to her in the privacy of her boudoir, before she hid them with the creams and powders and rouges. "How much more time is there, my darling?" she asked sadly, but silently. "Yesterday we were young and immortal, but today I see at last that there is a term to all things." At that moment, Blaine looked across at her, and she saw his quick concern as he noticed her expression. He murmured an apology to the others and came to her side. "Why so serious on such a lovely day?" he smiled. "I was thinking how shameless you are, Blaine Malcolmus," she answered, and his smile slipped.
"What is it, Santaine?
How can you blatantly parade your mistress before the crowned heads of empire?" she demanded. "I have no doubt it is a capital crime. You could have your head struck off on Tower Green." He stared at her for a moment, and then the grin came back, boyish and jubilant. "My dear lady, there must be some way I can escape that fate. What if I were to change your status from scarlet mistress to demure wife?" She giggled. She very seldom did that, but when she did, he found it irresistible. What an extraordinary time and place to receive a proposal of marriage, and an even more extraordinary time and place to accept one. "What do you think their majesties would say if I were to kiss you here and now?" He leaned towards her, and she leapt back, startled.
"Crazy man, you just wait until I get you home," she threatened.
He took her arm, and they went to join the company. "Veldhoven is one of the loveliest homes in the Cape," Blaine agreed, "but it doesn't belong to me. And I want to carry my bride over the threshold of my own home." "We cannot live in Newland's house." Santaine did not have to say more, and for a moment Isabella's ghost passed between them like a dark shadow.
"What about the cottage?"
He laughed to banish Isabella's memory.
"It's got a magnificent bed. What else do we need?"
"We'll keep that," she agreed, "and every now and then we will slip away to revisit it."
"Dirty weekends, goodo."
"You are vulgar, do you know that?" she said.
"So, where shall we live?" he asked.
"We will find a place, our own special place." It was 500 acres of mountain, beach and rocky coastline, with a profusion of protea plants and grand views across Hout Bay and out to the cold green Atlantic. The house was a huge rambling Victorian mansion, built at the turn of the century by one of the old mining magnates from the Witwaters Rand, and in desperate need of the attention that Santaine proceeded to lavish upon it. However, she kept the name Rhodes Hill. For her, one of its chief attractions was that a mere 20 minutes in the Daimler took her over the Constantia Neck Pass and down to the vineyards of Veldhoven. Chasseur had taken over the chairmanship of Courtney Mining and Finance at the war's end, although Santaine kept a seat on the board and never missed a meeting. Now Chasseur and Tara moved into the great chateau of Veldhoven that she had vacated. But Santaine visited there every weekend and sometimes more often. It gave her a pang when Tara rearranged the furniture that she had left and re-landscaped the front lawns and gardens. But with an effort, she managed to hold her tongue. Often these days, she thought of the old bushman couple who had rescued her from the sea and the desert. And then she would sing softly the praise song that Oa had composed for the infant Chasseur. "His arrows will fly to the stars, and when men speak his name, it will be heard as far. And he will find good water. Wherever he travels, he will find good water. Although, after all these years, the clicks and tones of the San language tripped strangely on her tongue, she knew that the blessing of Owa had borne fruit. That and her own rigorous training had led Shasa to the good waters of life. Gradually, Shasa, with the help of David Abrahams in Windhoek, had instilled into the sprawling Courtney Mining and Finance Company a new spirit of youthful vigor and adventure. Although the old hands, A.B. Abrahams and Twentyman Jones, grumbled and shook their heads, and although Sontaine was occasionally forced to side with them and veto Shasa's wilder, more risky projects, the company regained direction and increased in stature. Each time that Sontaine examined the books or took her seat below her son at the boardroom table, there was less to complain about and more cause for self-congratulation. Even Dr. Twentyman Jones, that paragon of pessimists, had been heard to mutter, "The boy has got a head on his shoulders." And then, appalled at his own lapse, he had added morosely, "Mind you, it will take a full day's work from all of us to keep it there." When Shasa had been nominated as the United Party candidate for the parliamentary by-election of Hottentots Holland, and had snatched a close-fought victory from his nationalist opponent, Sontaine saw all her ambitions for him becoming reality. He would almost certainly be offered something more important after the next general election, perhaps the job as Deputy Minister of Mines and Industry. After that, a full seat in the cabinet, and beyond that, she let the idea of it send little thrills up her spine, but did not allow herself to dwell on it in case the thought brought ill fortune on the actuality. Still, it was possible. Her son was well-favoured. Even the eye patch added to his individuality. He spoke amusingly and inarticulately, and he had the trick of making people listen and like him. He was rich and ambitious and clever. And he had herself and Tara behind him. It was possible and more than possible. By some remarkable dialectic contortion, Tara Malcolm-S. Courtney had retained her social conscience intact while taking up the management of the Veltevreden household, as though to the manner born. It was typical that she retained her maiden name and that she could rush from the elegant surroundings of Veltevreden to the slum clinics and feeding centres for the poor out on the Cape Flats without missing a step, taking with her larger charitable donations than Shasa really liked to part with. She threw herself into the duties of motherhood with equal abandon. Her first three efforts were all male, healthy and rumbustious. In order of seniority, they were Sean, Garrick and Michael. With her fourth visit to the childbed, she produced, with little effort and time wasted in labour, her masterpiece. This one, Tara named after her own mother, Isabella, and from the moment he first picked her up and she puked a little sour clotted milk on his shoulder, Shasa was totally besotted with her. Up to this time, it was Tara's spirit and intriguing individuality that had kept Shasa from growing bored and responding to the subtle and less than subtle invitations that were showered upon him by circling female predators. Sontaine, fully aware that Shasa's veins were charged with hot, teary blood, agonized that Tara seemed oblivious of the danger, and dismissed her veiled warnings with an offhand, "Oh, mater, Shasa isn't like that." Sontaine knew that was exactly the way he was. Mon Dieu, he started at 14! But she relaxed after the other women finally entered his life in the shape of Isabella de Thierry Malcolm-S. Courtney. It would have been so easy for a fatal slip to spoil it all, to dash the sweet cup from her lips just as she was able to savour it to the full. But now, at last, Sontaine was secure. She sat under the oaks beside the polo practice grounds of Veltevreden, a guest on the estate she had built up and cherished, but an honoured guest, and well content. The coloured nannies had charge of the babies, Michael just a year and a bit, and Isabella still at the breast. Sean was out in the middle of the field. He sat on the pommel of Shasta's saddle, shrieking with excitement and delight, as his father ran the pony at full gallop down between the far goalposts, brought him up short in a swirl of dust, pivoted, and came back in a crescendo of hoofbeats. Meanwhile, Sean, secure in the circle of Shasta's left arm, urged him, "Faster! Faster, Papa! Go faster!" On Santaine's knee, Garrick bounced impatiently. "Me!" he yelled. "Now, me!" Shasta brought the pony in, still at full gallop, and then reined him down to a dead stop. He lifted Sean off the pommel, against his best effort to stick like a bush tick. Garrick slipped off Santaine's lap and toddled to his father. "Me, Daddy! My turn!" Shasta leaned out of the saddle, swung the child up in front of him, and they were off again, at a gallop. It was a game of which they never tired. They had already exhausted two ponies since lunchtime. There was the sound of a motor vehicle coming down from the chateau, and Santaine sprang to her feet involuntarily as she recognised the distinctive beat of the Bentley's engine. Then she composed herself and went to meet Blaine with a little more dignity than her eagerness dictated. But as he stepped out of the vehicle, she saw his expression, and she quickened her step. "What is it, Blaine?" she demanded as he kissed her cheek. "Is something wrong?" "No, of course not," he assured her. "The Nationalists have announced their candidates for the Cape constituencies, that's all." "Who have they put up against you?" She was all attention now. "Old Van Schuur again?" "No, my dear, new blood. Someone you have probably never heard of, David Van Niekerk." "Who have they nominated for Hottentots Holland?" When he hesitated, she was immediately insistent. "Who is it, Blaine?" He took her arm and began to walk her slowly back to join the family at the tea table under the oaks. "Life is a strange thing," he said. "Blaine Malcolmus, I asked you for an answer, not a few gems of homespun philosophy. Who is it?" "I'm sorry, my dear," he murmured regretfully. "They have nominated Manfred de la Rey as their official party candidate." Santaine stopped dead, and she felt the blood drain from her face. Blaine tightened his grip on her arm to steady her as she swayed on her feet. Since the beginning of the war, Santaine had heard or seen nothing of her second, unacknowledged son. Shasta began his campaign with an open meeting in the Boy Scouts Hall of Somerset West. He and Tara drove out the 30 miles from Cape Town to this beautiful little village which nestled at the foot of Sir Lowry's Pass, beneath the rugged barrier of the Hottentots Holland Mountains. Tara insisted that they take her old Packard. She never felt comfortable in Shasta's new roles. "How can you bear to drive around on four wheels that cost enough to clothe, educate and feed 100 black children from the cradle to the grave?" For once, Shasta saw the practical wisdom of not flaunting his wealth in front of his constituents. Tara was really tremendous value for money, Shasta reflected. An aspiring politician could not ask for a better running mate. A mother of four lovely children, outspoken, holding strong opinions, and possessing a natural shrewdness that anticipated the prejudices and fickle enthusiasm of the herd. She was also strikingly beautiful, with all that smouldering auburn hair, and a smile that could light up a dreary meeting. And despite four childbirths in almost as many years, her figure was still marvellous. Small waist, good hips. Only her bosom had burgeoned. "I'll back her in a showdown with Jane Russell. Tit for tat she'd win by a length going anyway." Shasta chuckled aloud, and she looked across at him.
"That's your dirty laugh," she accused. "Don't tell me what you're thinking. Let me hear your speech instead."
He rehearsed it for her, with appropriate gestures, and she made an occasional suggestion on content and delivery. "I would pause longer there, and look fierce and determined, or I wouldn't make too much of that bit about the Empire. Not really in fashion any more." Tara still drove furiously, and the journey was soon over. There were larger-than-life posters of Shasta pasted at the entrance, and the hall was gratifyingly full. All the seats were taken, and there were even a dozen or so younger men standing at the back. They looked like students. Shasta doubted they were old enough to vote. The local United Party organizer, a party rosette on his lapel, introduced Shasta as a man who needed no introduction, and extolled the fine work he had done for the constituency during his previous short term of office.